We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we talked to an Urbana children's author whose new book was inspired by the Thorne Miniature Rooms at the Art Institute of Chicago. We search out the self-described Elvisologist known as Blelvis, and we hear from the author of Creepiosity, a hilarious guide to the unintentionally creepy, and we'll learn what really creeps him out. We'll have those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. The Thorne Miniature Rooms at the Art Institute of Chicago are a collection of dollhouse-sized rooms built in the 1930s to depict European and American interiors through the centuries. Seen one way, they're a crash course in decorative art history. But to the thousands who visit them each year, the Thorne Rooms are magical. For Urbana resident Marianne Malone, the magic was so potent that she imagined what it would be like to go inside the Thorne Rooms in a new book for young people. Illinois Public Media's Jim Meadows talked with the first-time author of The 68 Rooms.
The Thorne Miniature Rooms are the catalyst for everything that happens in The 68 Rooms, a book named for the number of Thorne Rooms in the Art Institute's collection. In this excerpt, read by author Marianne Malone, the Thorne Rooms make a deep impression on the book's 11-year-old heroine, Ruthie.
Looking through the glass fronts of these rooms, which were each about the size of two or three shoeboxes, Ruthie couldn't get over how realistic they were, like enchanted little worlds. Some had high ceilings and elaborate woodwork and finely carved furniture. Some looked like medieval castles. Others looked cozy and inviting. There were miniature paintings, carpets, toys, books, and musical instruments. Many of the rooms had doors through which you could peer into small side rooms and hallways. She could even see out the windows to street scenes and gardens complete with trees and flowers, or to painted landscapes beyond.
Malone says she shares Ruthie's fascination with the Thorne Rooms and used to visit them frequently while growing up in the Chicago suburbs. The rooms are named for Mrs. James Ward Thorne, a wealthy Chicago society matron who was also something of a self-taught historian. Lindsay McCann Morgan, who oversees the Thorne Rooms at the Art Institute, says Mrs. Thorne had both the means and the passion to create the rooms, doing meticulous research and hiring skilled craftspeople to build them on a scale of 1 inch to 1 foot.
All these things are made by a person by hand, handcrafted. There's a clock that works, and to imagine the scale of the gear work in that clock that's actually functioning. The count of the rugs is 40 count. It's pretty impressive, the detail that these rooms go into.
Marianne Malone says the idea for the book came at a time when she had been thinking about her childhood visits to the Thorne Rooms. She talked to her two grown daughters and found they had the same warm memories.
And I had been teaching at the time, and often within the process of teaching, you make miniature things. And some of my students had actually decorated their cubbies as little interiors, little mini Thorne Rooms that they would invent themselves. So it was bubbling in my head, I guess, thinking about them. And one day after I'd been teaching all day, I came home and took a little nap and woke up and had the idea for the book right there. The whole arc of the story came full bloom into my head with these two characters. And I went right down to my computer. It was, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and wrote sort of a 4-page sketch of this idea. And I said to my husband at dinner, I think I have a really good idea.
In the 68 rooms, Ruthie and her friend Jack come across a magic key that allows them to shrink down to just the right size to enter the Thorne Rooms. Staying after hours at the Art Institute one night, they use the magic key, enter the miniature rooms, and discover that the rooms serve as gateways to the actual places and times they depict. Malone reads another excerpt from her book in which Ruthie and Jack meet Sophie, a 14-year-old French girl living in the days of King Louis XVI.
"Next year I'm to be married," she said. Jack and Ruthie looked at each other. Ruthie tried to picture her sister, Claire, who was just a couple of years older than Sophie, being married. She couldn't. "Married? Who will you marry?" Ruthie asked. "I do not know yet," she said. "Of course, it will be someone at court. That is all I know. My father will arrange it." She stated all this as a somewhat sad matter of fact. "But I want to hear more about your country. Tell me all about your revolution."
You picked two dangerous times. Mm-hmm. That one in 18th century France, and then in New England, just about the time of the Salem witch trials.
Right.
But the kids don't actually get into the thick of it.
They affect these lives a little bit, but I didn't want them to be participants too much in history. That would have been a different book, I think, altogether. And also, you know, I studied art history in college, and I love art history, and I'm married to an art historian, and there's something about knowing the stories that objects have that can tell you, that can open up about history, is a little bit of the subtext of the book. I look at those thorn rooms, and I think many people do, and not only are they wonderful and magical escapism, but they also tell you a lot about how people lived when you look at the interiors and the objects that they were among. So I think I wanted the kids to have a sense of that and have it be really well illustrated with meeting these people, but I didn't want them to participate in history too much.
Ruthie and Jack have as much adventures in and around the Thorn Rooms as they do inside them. At one point, while in their miniature state, the children have to battle an unfriendly cockroach. And on a more practical level, their unauthorized overnight stay at the Art Institute includes the challenge of making it to the restrooms without getting caught by the museum guards. You know, one thing that struck me about the book and what you had the two kids doing is they both approached the Thorn Rooms in different ways, that you had Ruthie fascinated by the worlds of the rooms, mm-hmm. while Jack seemed to be interested in how the whole thing worked, how the whole rooms were set up, what was going on behind the scenes.
Right. I wanted them to be opposites. He's a sort of adventurous character. Ruthie's a little bit more of an observer. She's a little more cautious in life. But she loved the rooms, first of all. She's sort of a girl who was, I set her up with somebody who had to share a bedroom in her kind of smallish apartment, and she's always craving more and beautiful space, very much like I did as a child. I shared a room for many, many years with my sister. And that's a drive for her, this idea of place and beautiful places and places that are exciting and can take you away from what you think of as your rather regular life. Jack doesn't have that feeling because his life doesn't seem regular anyway. So they approach it from very different points.
The 68 Rooms has done well enough in its first months of publication that a sequel is now in the editing stages. The book is on sale at the Art Institute, where Thorn Rooms curator Lindsay McCann Morgan says she's overheard it mentioned by some of the children who visit. But while Ruthie and Jack may once again outwit the museum guards for an overnight visit to the Thorn Rooms, Morgan warns against anyone else who might have the same idea.
I won't go into details, but there are a few things that wouldn't quite fly in reality, but I definitely wouldn't recommend doing that at any age. It's a little bit dangerous and also a little bit naughty.
The 68 Rooms by Marianne Malone is published by Random House. I'm Jim Meadows, Illinois Public Media.
This is Sidetrack. Joy Jones was having a hard time getting motivated to work out, so she decided to get rid of the work part of the equation and start playing again. She picked up a jump rope, and between the stumbling and the bumbling, she began to rediscover her rhythm, and she's attracted a following. Every Friday, people gather at the Turkey Thicket Recreation Center in Washington, D.C. for some good old-fashioned double dutch. Independent producer Andrew Hiller has more.
When I enter the Turkey Thicket Recreational Center, children are playing billiards and racquetball, but in the gymnasium, fully grown adults are jumping rope. Now, we're not talking about Rocky Balboa doing some cardio to get ready for a fight. We're talking about playground stuff.
I like coffee, I like tea, I like the boys like me. Yes, no, maybe so. Yes, no, maybe so. Yes, no. Maybe so. Yes.
Oh, they like it. They like it.
In double dutch, two ropes are spun simultaneously while the jumper tries to time their leaps, skips, or tricks without getting tripped up. Joy Jones leads the adult double dutch group. She explains how she reconnected with the schoolyard pastime.
The thing that came first was too much weight around my hips and my stomach. That's what came first. And I was looking for ways to get rid of it. And I like exercising, but even more than exercising, I like to play. And double dutch is a way to play and be fit all at the same time. So the traditional adult exercises, they were good, but the opportunity to revisit my childhood, that was even greater.
For many jumpers, Joan says relearning double dutch quickly becomes old rope.
For those who jumped double dutch as kids, once they get in the rope, the rhythm comes back and it's like riding a bike, you don't forget. Then we have those adults who never did it as kids and they're a little bit apprehensive. But when they see people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, sometimes even older, jumping rope, how can you not expect to be able to do it yourself? And it usually takes us about 10 minutes before somebody's jumping if they've never jumped before.
Some not only jump, they take command.
Faster.
Turn around.
Back up a little bit. Faster. Faster. Faster.
Terrain Bonneau drives in all the way from Alexandria just to be a part of the group.
I get bored easily, and I was actually looking out this opportunity. I kept looking in the city paper. I kept looking on Craigslist to see, you know, activity partners, if anyone was doing this in the city. I'm not doing it to burn a particular amount of calories. I'm not doing it to, you know, jump for a particular amount of time. I'm really here just to have fun, and I brought a couple friends with me as well. You know, just to kind of be somewhat nostalgic, and this is what we were doing when we were younger, and we get to do it again in our 30s.
When you think of jump roping, often you think of the ladies. Mm-hmm. Is there a stigma that you had to overcome to be a part of this?
Definitely. Don't notice it now as an adult. I guess, you know, there are a couple guys there. But as a kid, definitely. I started jumping when I was in the fifth grade, I think. Never really was into the whole basketball during recess, any of that. So I think, you know, some girls just asked me, hey, you want to try this? And I kind of got hooked.
Tamika Washington says that adult double dutch is a lot of fun. And it's really good exercise.
It's definitely very engaging with the cardio, getting the heart rate going, and it's fun. And so, and plus you see it, just like you see cheerleading now, it being accepted as a sport with competitions, double dutch has competitions, because it's serious. I take it very seriously.
And while jumping may be serious business, Washington says the double dutch is not just about the jumper. It's also about the people with their hands on the ropes.
A lot of people, they take for granted the turners. The turners are very important because if you have bad turners, then that can really mess up your jump. So because I don't mind turning at all because there's an art to turning. I don't think a lot of people understand that because you have to watch that person's feet. Because for those people who aren't really confident, they may slow up or slow down. And so the average person who isn't paying attention as turning, the rope will just mess up. But if you're really paying attention to what the jumper is doing as a turner, then you can go with them and keep the rope going for as long as they can.
While the adult double dutch at Turkey Thicket is for everyone, Joy Jones also leads the DC Retro Jumpers, a group that performs more advanced jumping feats.
We do what's called a pop-up, where you jump up high in the sky and come back in step. We bob and weave, where several people are in the rope, and we wind our ways around one another. We even have one trick where two jumpers hand dance in the rope. That means they're doing a partnered dance while jumping in the rope. And then we have another trick where a member can jump the rope double dutch while at the same time jumping a single rope all at once.
The jumping can get complicated, but most of Turkey Thicket come for a simpler reason. Josephine Morris Young.
Yes, and that's why we do it just for fun. There are groups out there who are more professional and serious about it, but we do it for the fun and the exercise. And when we mess up, we don't consider it as a mess up. We consider it as a pause, and we laugh, and sometimes we do really silly things that make the group laugh because it's a stress reliever, too. I mean, we all work high-stressful jobs, and this kind of relieves the stress, so that laughter always helps.
So at the end of double dutch jump roping, do they ever get double dutch chocolate?
At the end of double dutch jump roping, we're pretty much tired. That's about it.
So the exercise is the treat. No sweets out.
That's correct.
It is an exercise in rhythm, cooperation, and a few giggles. Hoping not to trip up on my lines, I'm Andrew Hiller.
You're tuned to Sidetrack. Each summer, Hawaii's annual ukulele festival, pronounced ukulele on the islands, attracts thousands of people from around the world. Portuguese immigrants brought the forerunner of the small guitar-like instrument to Hawaii in the late 1800s. Hawaiians adapted it and called it ukulele, meaning jumping flea. Lately, the instrument is seeing a resurgence, as independent producer Heidi Chang found out when she attended the festival's 40th anniversary this year.
For ukulele virtuoso Jake Shimabukuro, performing at the ukulele festival in Hawaii is a homecoming. Born in Hawaii, he started playing the ukulele when he was 4 years old. Now in his 30s, Shimabukuro is inspiring a new generation of players across the globe.
People's perception the way that they view the ukulele is changing now. It's not just about, oh, it's this little, you know, tiny, cheesy instrument that can play, you know, simple songs, but people are starting to see that, wow, this is an instrument that's very serious. You know, you can play everything from Bach to jazz standards to rock and roll. I mean, you can pretty much do whatever you want with it.
And he has. Shimabukuro's life changed a few years ago when a video of him playing While My Guitar Gently Weeps went viral on YouTube. Since then, he's gone on to perform with artists like Jimmy Buffett and Yo-Yo Ma. Shimabukuro says one reason the popularity of the ukulele continues to grow is you hear it more in mainstream music and media these days.
Because of things like YouTube and Google, people have instant access, you know, to all this music and to learning how to play the ukulele and to being exposed to other ukulele players.
That's what happened to Nico Salzak.
I was in France and I searched a video about ukulele on YouTube. The first name who appears is Jake Shimabukuro. I saw my guitar Gently Weeks and wow, it was great. After that, I don't want to touch any guitar. Just ukulele.
Salzek flew in from France to make his debut at the ukulele festival, playing the theme from the Pink Panther. Roy Sakuma founded the festival in 1971 to showcase the versatility of the ukulele as a solo instrument.
I never imagined from the first annual ukulele festival that it would get to a point like this where it has grown so big. There are ukulele festivals all over the world, from Japan down to Korea and China to Taiwan to New Zealand. And it goes across the United States all the way to Europe, to countries like Denmark, Sweden, Holland, France, Germany, Israel, England. It is incredible.
Each year, hundreds of ukulele enthusiasts, like 71-year-old Masami Kobayashi, come from Japan to perform at the festival. Kobayashi, who wrote a book about the ukulele, has watched its popularity grow in Japan.
Many people dance the hula and come over to Hawaii to study the dance. Hula dancers have to have ukulele backup, so ukulele music also getting popular together with hula.
It's not just adults who take part in the festival. Hundreds of kids play in an ukulele orchestra. This year, 8-year-old Aiden LaPrette Powell also performed as a solo artist. Never know who might become the next ukulele virtuoso. Just ask Jake Shimabukuro, who got his start as a kid performing here at the Ukulele Festival in Hawaii. I'm Heidi Chang in Honolulu.
You're listening to Sidetrack. Danville is going to look a little brighter by the end of the week. Artists from around the world are gathering in the city to paint a collection of murals on downtown buildings that capture the community's history from its famous natives to old businesses. Illinois Public Media's Sean Powers recently had a chance to get acquainted with a group of artists known simply as the Wall Dogs.
My name is Dave Carell. I'm from Faribault, Minnesota. I'm doing the Lincoln 50 and Wall.
My name is David Butler. I'm from Syracuse, Indiana. My particular project here is a John Rissman and Son.
To kick off this year's Wall Dogs event, about 100 artists, Danville City employees, and residents gather at the Boat Club on the city's northwest side to meet the people who will literally transform parts of downtown.
Hello, everybody. My name is Jeff Harvey. I come from New Zealand. The thing is here, folks, you will not see this anywhere else in the world apart from these 4 days in Danville. And it's such a pleasure to be a part of it. Thank you very much.
Carl Scott Lindley goes by his Wall Dog alias Cornbread, and he's organizing this year's meetup. An artist by trade, Lindley's been a Wall Dog for nearly 5 years. And he says once you're in for life.
The projects they do, the kind of things that they... Why would you not want to be around anything that positive? So, except for Michael Clark here.
What would you want to...
Well, I was trying to wonder what my designation is. What you're
top dog.
Is it top dog?
You are top dog. Yeah. With the amount of work that you've done to make this event a reality, you are the top dog.
Well, thank you.
And with that, Lindley takes me to downtown Danville, where more than a dozen projectors are casting slide projections of 15 murals.
You end a Wall Dog meet at a certain period of time, and you're left feeling something. What do you think you're going to be feeling by the end of this week?
At the end of a meet, it's like the end of a family reunion. You know, it's just kind of like you got to say your goodbyes, and you wish that it was longer, but you got to do whatever it takes to make this happen because you don't want to let a lot of people down.
One bare wall has a projected image of Dick Van Dyke, a Danville native. Another is a logo of Danville's own Chuckles Candy. A third mural will feature the Vermilion River.
We were going to do
Meet the designers of the Vermilion River Wall. They go by the Three Bernies, and you can tell they're not singing stars. Bernie Giedel is from Carlinville, Illinois, and Bernie Lohmeyer is from Osage City, Kansas.
I'm Bernie 2. He's Bernie 1.
The other one's Bernie 3.
Bernie 3, yeah. Yeah, he's the... brains of the operation.
He's the good.
I'm the ugly.
The third Bernie is Bernie Poff of Prairie du Sac, Wisconsin. Poff is measuring the wall that'll serve as this group's canvas.
It's not 30. Who said this wall was 30? It's only 29 feet, 9 inches.
Uh-oh, where's Scott at?
Grab it.
We'll have to shrink the river or something.
As the three Bernies set up shop, 83-year resident Jean Quick watches on with her niece Jill. They say the murals are exactly what the city needs.
I love the city of Danville. I will always love the city of Danville. And I think we have more here than people realize, especially when you look at all the people who are out here tonight.
It's just going to be great. I hope it brings a lot of business and put Danville on the map, hopefully.
Do you think it's going to put it on the map?
I hope.
In about a day, all of the Wall Dogs will transform downtown and then pack up and leave. Many of the residents here say the murals will be something that future generations can be proud of. I'm Sean Powers, Illinois Public Media.
We have a link to see a slideshow of all the murals being painted this week in Danville. Just visit our website at will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Still to come, we hear about the Creepiosity Index, and we search for Blelvis, the self-described Elvisologist. Stay tuned. Thank you. For some, it's a chortle or a chuckle. For others, a giggle or a cackle. Sometimes it can even be a high-pitched shriek. No matter how you say it, laughter is often described as the best medicine. And for Katie West of Bath, Maine, it's not only a way of life, but a tool for survival. She is a life coach, a businesswoman, and she is trying to spread her joy for life with laughter and play in public spaces.
Laughter is... amazing and life-giving and healing, and I can't do enough of it. It's just that good.
Laughter is the light. It's the one thing that makes the darkness disappear, and it is the most powerful weapon on earth.
Laughter is the song of my spirit.
Laughter is soul food.
It brings about an amazing peace. So whenever I get stressed out, I always try to remember.
We are standing in New York City, and it is May 2nd, 2010. It is World Laughter Day. We're going to come together and ride on the subway trains, as well as put on an event in Grand Central Station. My name is Katie West, and I am founder of the Levity Institute, which is a life coaching, training, research, and social change building organization. And our whole mission is to help bring a sense of lightheartedness back to our society. So this all started when I went to New York City in March 2009, and while I was on the subway train, I had this amazing experience. I was just listening to my music on my headphones, and I started smiling, just really enjoying the day and enjoying the moment. And I opened my eyes, realizing that I had a broad smile on my face, and people around me were frowning. So the Levity Project started on that day.
This is Grand Central, 42nd Street.
May I have your attention, please?
Right now, we are about to have a laughter party in the middle of Grand Central Station. Basically, a dream of mine for a long time. I do this because it's fulfilling and it's fun and it's joyful. And when I kind of started to look at all the things I did well, I realized, oh, I play really well. Can I actually get away with doing that for my work and for my pastime? I think this work is so important to me because of growing up in a house where depression was prevalent, and that was the norm, and there was a lot of love and a lot of kindness, but depression has a power to squash everything down. I think that there can be the tendency for people to assume that I've always had this happy-go-lucky experience. I had a dreamy childhood with a picket white fence, because my childhood wasn't necessarily easy. My parents split up when I was young, and my mom was severely depressed for my childhood and is still depressed. And it was clear that, she cared about us and loved us. But, when you struggle with severe depression, it's different than mild depression. There's no getting out. It's a durable track that you're just on. And that's why I have such gratitude for my mom, because I'm not making her story my story. And I feel like for me, she may never have this in her life. She may never get to see the joy I feel. And so to me, it's like the same as living well for the people that aren't able to be alive. Well, isn't that my same responsibility to live as joyfully as I can? And I don't mean happy and fake. I mean joyful, like, with soul, because there are people who are depressed that will never feel this. This practice that we're going to do today of laughter is going to be infusing our bodies with oxygen. It's very simple. I mean, what is laughter when you think about it? It's just ha 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 ha. Okay? So why don't you try that with me? Just inhale. Ha 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 ha. Laughter yoga is the practice of laughing for no reason. It is using laughter as exercise to affect a body-mind shift.
2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
When we just start laughing, we can't hold on to the tensions that we came into the space with. For that moment where laughter is present, we have to release that. Laughter to me is joy expressed, you know, through our body and out into our experience.
Excellent, you've just passed laughter 101. So what you're going to do now...
You know, sometimes it gets me a little fiery because I feel like people don't see that this is a practice and this is a choice, and that every day I wake up and I could choose to look at any number of things that has happened in my life, and that alone could paralyze me. And it's not, that's not what I choose. Levity is not about denying any of the struggle we face or, you know, putting up a blind eye to it. It's embracing it and letting it take us to a new place. And what is hard and dark doesn't necessarily need to pull us down into our grave, but it can pull us up to a place that helps us see the heavens.
That feature was produced by Avery Moore while attending the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies. You're tuned to Sidetrack. What is creepy? According to David Bakel, it can be anything from styrofoam wig holders to Canadian coins to fishes with people faces. And, of course, clowns. To him, clowns make everything creepier. And when it comes to creepy things, Bakel is a bit of an expert. He has recently published Creepiosity, a hilarious guide to the unintentionally creepy. The book is published by Andrews McMeel Publishing. I recently talked with Bakel about his Creepiosity Index and had him first explain the difference between the creepiness of, say, haunted houses and old cemeteries and the everyday, unexpected creepy.
That's the whole key to the whole thing, is unintentionally. I don't care about demons and monsters and gargoyles. It means nothing to me. I want the, you know, the old lady with the really long hair or the squirrel that looks at you too long. That's what I like.
And for this book, Creepiosity, you have created an index.
Yeah.
And what's your criteria for the index?
The Creepiosity Index is a very, very complicated formula that research goes into it. To explain it to a layman, no offense, very, very complicated. Very scientific. That's the key to the whole thing. That we have a study with volunteers, and we put up diodes and different meters to rate how creepy something is. And the reason I use that system is because when somebody gets offended by something in the book, I can go, listen, it's just science. It's not me.
Exactly.
It really is a good app.
So why do you feel there's a need for an index to rate things on their level of creeposity?
It's to kind of give people like an idea of how one thing is creepy against another thing. It's like rating anything. It's just, I guess, to make people aware that if you're going to see, for example, a grown man in a Boy Scout uniform, especially out of context, what they should be ready for, you know? How creepy is that? And again, it's as scientific as it is, people have their own ideas, so it's kind of subjective, too.
Well, where did the idea for this book come from?
I'm a big list guy. I'm always making lists of different things. And one of the things I always made a list of since I was a little kid were things that creeped me out that weren't trying to creep me out. And probably the earliest one I can remember was my mother had one of those white styrofoam wig heads, you know, those really creepy things that they put wigs on.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, and she had no wigs, so that really made it creepy. And I wasn't sure why she had it. But that was the first thing that I ever thought. It was like, wow, that really creeps me out, and yet it's not trying to. And I'm sure it was trying to kill me in the middle of the night. So that's really the genesis of the whole thing.
Some of the items in your book are pretty obvious. Lifelike, baby dolls, Band-Aids on the ground, birthday party clowns. Yeah, I think a lot of people would say, yeah, that's creepy. But other ones, honestly, I don't think are that creepy. They're more maybe sad or out of place.
Like what?
Well, Canadian coins.
Well, yeah, okay. Again, this is, we live in America. You could have your opinion on how creepy something is, whether it's creepy at all. And you'll notice it's got a low creepiosity index.
Right.
So I'm not saying you're going to be terrified by it, but I define creepiness by anything that makes you feel a little uncomfortable. Just gets under your skin a little bit. And when I'm going to buy a candy bar and I dig my hand in my pocket and all of a sudden I got some crazy Canadian coin in my hand that, and the machine doesn't take it, very creepy to me.
So what really creeps you out? I mean, what's the genesis of what creeps you out? Where's the root of that?
You know what? I think that if there's a formula to the book, it is the creepiest things are things, that get under your skin a little bit, but also too much of anything is creepy. Like, for example, people who play bingo, God bless, it's a great, fun thing, but people who take it way too far, it gets a little creepy. Like, if you have, like, one little stuffed animal in the rear window of your car, all right, that's not my thing, but I get it. When you have 50 of them, that's when it gets creepy. Even butterflies are cute when there's one or two, but if there's a herd of them, I don't know if that's the right word, herd, of butterflies, but even if there's a lot of them, it's too many.
You talked about this styrofoam head that influenced you as a youth. Since then, what is the creepiest thing you've come across?
That's a great question. I actually had I work in television. I actually had a meeting about 5 or 6 years ago with Michael Jackson, and I was hanging out with Michael Jackson for an hour and a half in a hotel room. That qualifies as one of the creepiest things I've ever personally been involved in.
Really?
Yeah, it was really, really, like, surreal. Very strange.
How so?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's Michael Jackson. So you get there and you expect, you've seen all the pictures and all the things they say about him, and then you get in there and you see the actual thing close up, and it's startling. Just an odd, creepy guy. And I'm using creepy not necessarily as a bad thing. I don't think it necessarily means something is bad if it's creepy. It's just, you know, again, gets under your skin a little bit. But we had a conversation, and we were talking about all different things, and I was kind of getting used to it, and we were talking about movies at a certain point, and we were talking about what's your favorite movie, what's your favorite movie, and his favorite movie, if I wrote this, you'd say I'm crazy, but his favorite movie of all time was Boys Town, and it was like, for me, I was like, doing everything I could not to laugh, but I thought, if you're Michael Jackson, just say Die Hard, you know? don't invite that.
Wow.
Very strange.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you also have a blog and a Twitter feed to go along with this book, and it seems like this is an ongoing project for you. Have there things that have popped up recently that you wish were in the book that have really, you know, piqued your meter recently?
Oh, definitely. We have the website and the Twitter, but more so the Facebook page. We're very interactive. People sending their posts and sending links and pictures and stuff, and tons of great stuff that, and I'm not regretting it because I'm thinking about writing another one. So I'm getting just really, really good ideas from people. People are very funny. It's great.
So exactly, what has popped up recently that has really creeped you out?
It was a very funny one. Somebody wrote something about hugs that are a little too aggressive, are a little creepy. And the way he put it was very funny. He said, when our middles touch. And that was a funny way of putting it. And that I remember cracked me up. And somebody the other day said, that Oates from Hall & Oates without his mustache. A little creepy.
Uh-huh.
Very, very funny. So, and you know, again, just videos and pictures and all kinds of stuff to riff off of, which is a great lot of fun.
So where do you go from here?
As far as Creepiosity goes?
Yeah, you know, you said maybe another book, you know, the Creepiosity World Tour. Where do you go?
Definitely another book. We're talking with the publisher right now about it because the book is doing far better than I ever thought it would. And people are talking about board games and, you know, greeting cards and stuff like that. And just whatever it is, just spread the word around and have fun and kind of just open up this world a little bit for people to explore about things that personally creep them out. It's just a whole lot of fun.
So if people want to learn more, where should they go?
All right, so the website is creepycreepycreepy.com, and that'll get you to the Creepiosity website. Twitter is Creepiosity, Creepiosity, and the same spelling for the Facebook page, which is awesome.
That's David Bickel, author of Creepiosity, a hilarious guide to the unintentionally creepy. It's published by Andrews McMeel Publishing. You're listening to Sidetrack. First, there was the art movement Fluxus. Then the marshmallow spread Fluffernutter. Now meet two members of the Flarfist Collective, a group of poets spawned in the digital age. Independent producer Diane Richards has the story.
Maria Damon has an intriguing way of describing the stick-in-your-eye poetry movement known as flarf.
If laugh were an F word, it would be flarf, because it sounds like laugh, larf, fluffy, this kind of overly cutesy, weird, nonsense, baby talk. Sounds like freak. It sounds like fart. Sounds like barf. It just collapses everything that's both endearingly sort of cuddly and funny and ridiculous and adolescent scatological humor at its, you know, at its most unabashed.
Damon is a professor of English literature at the University of Minnesota. On this summer night, she's sitting across the table from the poet Elizabeth Workman.
For me, flarf opens up so many possibilities in poetry and with language too. So for me, it's awesome bad.
The Flarf List Collective started in 2001 with a poem by Gary Sullivan. It begins like this.
Oh yeah, baby, gonna shake and bake, then take all your money, honey. Tee-hee.
Flarf has been poking a stick at everything overtly poetic, precious, or profound ever since.
So how do you know if something is flarf or just bad poetry?
Well, it depends on who wrote it. And the intent, I would say, more than who wrote it. The thing about flarf is it's very knowing. It's not bad poetry that thinks it's good.
Flarfies, as Damon calls them, tend to be poetry insiders and beyond bookish. Workman's poetry recently earned her a McKnight Grant.
You are an accomplished poet. You just received this amazing grant to do your work. Will you practice flarf exclusively moving forward, or do you do a combination of different types of poetry?
The line kind of blurs for me, because I think before I was even part of the Flarf Collective, the way I worked in poetry was I was interested in the inappropriate. I was interested in the quote-unquote ugly, the irreverent, the awkward.
That interest explains how Workman and Damon came to be the Twin Cities, Twin Flarfies.
I actually adore stuff that other people wince at. That's one reason I cherish flarf so much, because here are some very highly accomplished poets who embrace whatever is considered to be just the, you know, the bottom feeding in the poetry world. They embrace it wholeheartedly and with a kind of zest and affection that I feel very sincerely about this poetry. And so it was like I found my people.
Flarf poetry spreads via the internet and at readings held at places like the Walker Art Center. Flarf has even landed on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Yet there are only about 30 Flarfies in the country.
It was a huge honor to be invited to be a part of the group, because really the most interesting poets, living poets right now, are part of this collective.
Much of FLARF's inspiration draws from blogs and web searches. Today, what Roger's thesaurus is to beginning poets, Google is to FLARF.
Google sculpting is the phrase used to describe the process by which a lot of FLARF poems are created. It's not the only mechanism for creating FLARF poems, but it is a dominant one. So, for example, entering the words reverence plus dwarf plus queefing results in a poem that I recently wrote about being pregnant.
That particular poem might curdle the public airwaves. Still.
I would love to hear an original Elizabeth Workman.
Yes. Let's. Can you read my favorite one by you?
Yeah, I'll read the Ars Poetica. So I think this is going to begin the collection. Visualize a forest, coppery violet, pulsating. Inside the forest is a looking egg. Peering into a little porthole at the end of the egg is a zealot. Inside the zealot is an antichrist. Inside the antichrist, poetry.
It's so unbelievable, that last line, poetry. It's like, okay, I don't have to write another word for the rest of my life because you just said it all.
To hear more FLARF poems, search for FLARF at youtube.com.
That feature was produced by Diane Richard for KFAI Community Radio in Minneapolis, St. Paul. That story is part of KFAI's 10,000 Fresh Voices series, made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. This is Sidetrack. When Elvis Presley died, he left behind an abundance of adoring fans. One of his most obsessive and mysterious admirers is a Washington, D.C. man known as Blelvis, a self-described Elvisologist. Independent producer Sam Greenspan set out to find out more about the man behind the persona.
If you've never met Blelvis, the Black Elvis of D.C., it would be impossible to pick him out in a crowd. He doesn't look like Elvis, he doesn't dress like Elvis, and he only sort of sounds like Elvis. Blelvis is more of an Elvisologist. He knows the words to every Elvis Presley song ever written. Through the years, Blelvis has become a fixture around Northwest D.C., and once you start asking around, it seems like everyone has a Blelvis story.
You hear about him first, and then eventually you run into him, and it's like seeing some rare bird.
Kind of came up next to me and started walking along with me and introduced himself as Blelvis the Black Elvis.
And then you run into him again, and then run into him again.
And I heard footsteps behind me on the street late at night. Of course, it's just Blelvis, and he gives me a friendly... Don't worry, baby. It's just me, Blelvis.
Eventually, you get to know him. He turns up at the most unexpected times. One time he showed up here at, around Christmas time with a big box of Hershey's chocolate and was just like, this is for you. It's a Christmas gift. Or as an Elvisologist, I hope he'll take it as a compliment that there's apparently a growing pool of Blelvisology.
The best way to meet Blelvis is by a chance encounter on the street. He'll come up to you and offer to sing an Elvis song, any Elvis song. If you don't know one, he'll ask you for a word and then make word associations until he finds a song that fits. And he wouldn't deny you the pleasure of donating money towards his services. But one of the first things you learn about Blelvis is that he's never around when you're looking for him. Still, if you can't find him performing his routine around Adams Morgan or the Wonderland Ballroom, you can always find him on YouTube.
Yeah, this week is Blelvis, who is a person who claims to know every word of every song Elvis ever sang.
This is from Rock and Roll Psychosis. It's a local student-produced talk show. It's 1987, and Blelvis looks like he's in his 20s. He's sporting a pompadour, sideburns, and a burgundy members-only jacket.
And you make the claim that you know every single word of every single song that Elvis ever did. Now, that's 1,000 songs. Am I correct in assuming?
Actually, it's 1,112.
And you know every word?
Yeah. Every word to every song ever recorded by Elvis.
Yoga is as yoga does.
Well, that was from Easy Come, Easy Go. Yoga is as yoga does. There's no in between. You're either with him all the way or you split the scene.
For decades, journalists have placed Blelvis in the media spotlight. He's been profiled by TV crews, bloggers, newspapers, And in June of 2009, I too started looking for him and began what became a citywide search for Blelvis. Searching for you.
I think in some ways he's built up such a mythic stature in DC folklore that you want to believe that there are, you know, Blelvical superpowers, but I think that he has a sticking power in people's minds, and so he makes you you want to believe in him.
Monica Hesse writes for the style section of the Washington Post. She wrote a feature on Blelvis in 2007 and might be the city's leading Blelvisologist.
I think that it's easy when you meet him for one night to think, A, either that he's just a figure of fun, that he's, you know, there for your entertainment, or it's easy to think that he's, you know, a tragic fallen hero. And he's neither of those things. He's a man, he's a person, and he's a very flawed person. Andrew's obsession with Elvis is one of the things that contributed to his marriage failing. I'm sure it wasn't the only thing. I know that at the time he also was battling drugs and I think alcohol. So did Elvis ruin Blelvis? I think in some ways he did, but I think that that's also a simple answer.
Here's what we know about Blelvis. His real name is Rondi Wooten, but mostly goes by his middle name, Andrew. He's named three children after Elvis. It's unclear if he's been homeless in the past, but either way, he lives a pretty marginal existence, driving a truck part-time.
When I was spending time with him, I would call him Andrew, at least when we were hanging out, not on the streets. But on the streets, he became Blelvis. And when he calls now and we'll chat, I have to remind myself to call him Andrew because, well, the person that you want to remember is Blelvis. But I can imagine that just as with any performer, the burden of being Blelvis is both a blessing and a curse. You know, I'm sure that Michael Jackson would have liked friends to call him Mike at home or something like that. So I always wanted to remember that it was a person that I was spending time with, not just a caricature.
Andrew's 44 now. Hesse wonders if he'll still be doing Blelvis at 80. It's been almost 2 months since I began looking for him, and I'm wondering, what if he has taken a break from being Blelvis? Maybe he finally hung up the blue suede shoes. For good.
When you meet by chance, it's not just by chance, it's kismet. When two hearts stand still.
Check, check, check. Okay, today is July 24th, 2009, and got a call that Blelvis is in Mount Pleasant. Okay, so we're just about to cross Park Road on 18th Street. Let's see. Oh, what's that?
But yeah, it was just funny.
Blelvis.
You played on a table.
Hey, you're Blelvis. I'm Sam.
Ah!
You're a hard man to find.
Well, here I am. So talk to me, because, this is Blelvis. So, you say I'm a hard man to find.
Andrew tells me that he and Elvis Presley were born on the same day, but that Blelvis was born on the day that Elvis died.
The day that Elvis died, August 16th, 77, okay, I was 11, almost 12, and I'm an average black kid in my room listening to an average station that a 12-year-old would listen to. Never play Elvis, of course. All of a sudden, Elvis, the king is dead, and they start playing Elvis music. So I get up, I turn to my second favorite station, Elvis music. Now I'm getting pissed. I get up to turn the third time, and You're So Square, Baby, I Don't Care comes on. So I'm about, and it comes on, I'm like, okay, that sounds good. Then after that, Treat Me Nice comes on, which is the flip side of Jailhouse Rock. Anyway, I end up sitting down and listening to Elvis all night that night. I'm like, wow, he put out some good stuff. A couple days later, I got my allowance, and I bought my first Elvis album, blah, blah, blah. There's an old Southern expression, whole hog or nothing at all.
What does that mean?
It means whatever you get into, go all the way with it or don't do it. Whole hog or nothing at all. And that's the kind of person I am.
Something that Andrew would always say is that he followed, that Elvis Presley always went whole hog or nothing at all. And that Blelvis was the same way. that he was either going to do something 100% or not do it at all.
Once again, Monica Hesse.
And so it does make you wonder, if he's doing Blelvis 100%, does that mean that he can't make room for anything else that would be stabilizing? So as a person who knows him, I mean, I'd like for Blelvis to live on, but I'd like for Andrew to just be stable. I don't know that that's the same path. We all struggle with being our own worst enemies, and I think that for most of us that exists in less visible, less flamboyant ways, but I think that the struggle that Andrew might have letting Blelvis take over his life is a struggle that we all have. We all continue to do things that might not be in our best interests.
I still want to know more, but every time I try to dig a little deeper to find out what Andrew thinks about the legend of Blelvis and the way that other people interpret his story, he stops me in my tracks. I start to wonder if he's getting a little resentful of me, just another reporter hound-dogging him for his story.
Sam, I would like to interview you.
Okay.
So how long have you been Sam? No, I'm just joking.
That's an interesting question, because not my whole life. No, I changed my name when I was 10.
Okay.
Well, it was my middle name, but I switched.
And my middle name is the name I go by. I mean...
Andrew.
Wow, you knew that. What's my first name?
Ron?
No.
Ronald? No.
No.
Rondi.
Absolutely right.
I told you, I've been looking for you, man.
Absolutely right. I hate that name.
Blelvis says he's going to run to the store for some cigarettes and tells me to wait. Even though it's the end of July, when he comes back, he's carrying a snow shovel. And even though it's almost midnight, he says he needs to return it to someone. He disappears into an alley next to the stoop where we had been talking. I don't see him again.
The fact that we keep wanting to tell his story says something more about us than it does about him. It's a worthwhile story to continue telling, but I think you're not the last journalist to do it. And I think that the interesting thing is that once you get swept up in Blelvis, you become a part of the story too. All of that means is that the next time someone does this story, they'll be calling you. And, you know, thus his legend expands in ever-widening circles.
I know I'd go from
that feature from Sam Greenspan. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. Past episodes of Sidetrack are available on our website. Just go to will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of Illinois Public Media.